The virtual me will remember what I watched a year ago or what I ordered a year ago. So now what we're going to be able to do is we're going to be able to basically put a fence around our digital identity and then give permission to whoever wants to use it.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. What do tokens, smart contracts, mining, time stamping, and blockchain technology all have in common? They are the essential parts of a complicated cryptocurrency industry, a new enterprise that is rapidly transforming global financial markets and the transaction landscape. Cryptocurrency is a digital asset designed to work as a medium of exchange. It uses encrypted data to secure financial transactions, make them transparent to users, and verify the transfer of assets. Since the creation of the first cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, in 2009, more than 4,000 other alternative coins have been created. The worth of major cryptocurrencies fluctuates wildly, with values varying from near zero to more than $1 million per unit. Today on Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, we are joined by two Montana-based experts on cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. Dr. Michael Braun is a University of Montana business professor, author, entrepreneur, and former investment banker. Chirag Patel is the digital asset manager at Glacier Coin Capital and has personally raised and managed more than $6 million for investment in the cryptocurrency market. Together, they will share their exciting experiences and cautionary tales and attempt to demystify this complicated and confusing new phenomena. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Welcome to the show, Mike and Chirag. Chirag, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Montana native, born and raised over here, you know, went to the business school here at the U of M, had Mike here as a professor for a few of my courses as well. Currently, I'm involved with a few different product-based businesses, but the most prominent is my digital asset hedge fund, Glacier Coin Capital. And what that does is aims to get individuals into investing into the cryptocurrency market. And I make it easier for you by educating you about the whole process and take you through what you really want to achieve.
And Mike, tell our listeners a little about you.
Well, I teach at the business school, and you know, one of the great rewards is when teacher becomes student, as in the case when Chirag really started to educate me on cryptocurrencies. I got involved about 3 years ago, really just for the sake of getting up the curve on what this entire space is. So, you know, small investments so I can get my skin in the game a little bit and figure out what's going on in the space.
So how did this all get started? Who wants to take a crack at that?
You know, I think to understand cryptocurrencies and the underlying blockchain technology, you kind of have to go back in time, really to the advent of the internet. And when you think about what happened in the mid to late 90s with the web 1.0, that was really a way for us to post and exchange information. And what we've seen in the last 20 years is sort of the evolution from Web 1.0 to 2.0. And, you know, now we have social media and we got folks buying stuff and selling stuff. And you do have, obviously, payment systems through credit cards. So people are, you know, engaging in e-commerce. But what we've seen also is that there are a lot of issues with today's internet, right? I mean, think about all the hacks that we see on an ongoing basis. I mean, just last week, Twitter got hacked. Even the CEO's account got hacked, right? You think about fake news. You think about sort of what our digital identities are doing when we're actually offline. All this information that is getting tracked about what we buy, what we read, who we visit, you know, with the sites that we visit. So there are a lot of shortcomings. And blockchain is really known as a trust technology, meaning that, you know, in 2008, there was a lot of distrust in institutions, in intermediaries such as banks, in governments, right? When you think back to 2008 and the Great Recession, and it was at that time that a person or persons who remain to this day unknown by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto came up with Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was really a blockchain enabled cryptocurrency that had sort of an ideal that it was going to be pseudonymous, meaning that all of a sudden you had a currency that you didn't necessarily have to know who was behind it, who owned it, right? It wasn't trackable. And the other thing is that it was peer-to-peer, meaning that I didn't have to go through an intermediary. I could send it directly to you, Arnie, and you could send it back to me, right? And through that, there was not going to be any transaction cost. So that's sort of the quick and short version of how we got to blockchain and then also Bitcoin.
So how many people really understand this in the world?
In the world, the learning curve still kind of there. Over the last 3 years or so, after seeing the recent bull run that Bitcoin had in 2017, a lot more people are familiar with the knowledge, but not really the underlying technology of blockchain. They see Bitcoin as kind of like a highly volatile asset, more or less, and don't really see it as a store of value, more than anything. But getting down to the foundation of it, if people understand why is Bitcoin around, what is its purpose, and what is it aiming to solve in the world, a lot more people will be more familiar with that technology and be more prone to actually using it and utilizing it.
Well, let's clear this up once and for all for our listeners. There are no coins that are being minted that are Bitcoins.
No physical coins, no.
No, this is a bit of technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
A snip of technology that is being called Bitcoin.
And Arnie, the way that I try to make it accessible to people, if they were to pull out their $1 bill or $20 bill and they look at it, on the left-hand side, it'll say this is legal tender that is basically backed by the government. And on the right-hand side of that dollar bill, there's a code, right? There's a serial number. Well, what Bitcoin does is it basically takes out that left-hand side that it's legal tender supported by the government. And it just goes with an encryption code, right? A number that now is blockchain, meaning that since its beginning, we have a full transparency of, you know, where that currency went. And the other thing is it's immutable, meaning that you can't go back and change it. So it's actually it's quite safe in terms of the encryption levels that you get.
And Chirag, given the fact that there's 4,000 different alternative coins, why has Bitcoin, the first one that emerged, still holds the place as the most dominant force in the industry?
Community. They've been able to foster a community from the time of its inception around there. And you have this individual or group referred to as Satoshi Nakamoto that created this currency. But the community that they had around this currency for the last 10 years and building it up has made it kind of like the gold standard in the market.
And really, what is the real potential for cryptocurrency?
Well, I mean, when you look at it, you see different financial institutions all around the world, whether it be banks, countries, you know, in Argentina, in Venezuela, you have hyperinflation of their currencies as well. You have currencies that are, you know, far more volatile than Bitcoin itself, and you're doing it by the faith of the government. So right now we're seeing the pendulum shift towards independence of the currencies itself, not being able to be manipulated by a higher power.
You know, this for the average person, this sounds, you know, very complicated. So,
well, let me add to that. You know, you're talking about potential, but what we're seeing is the use of Bitcoin is already pretty widespread, but it's actually more at the bottom of the pyramid. This is the sort of the poorest 2 to 3 billion people on the planet. And you have to think about that. A lot of those are not bankable, right? A lot of them don't even have birth records. They don't have enough money to actually open a bank account. And for them, what they do have is a smartphone. I mean, there's an assumption that, you know, in 10 years, 15 years time, the world is going to be completely Wi-Fi'd and that most of the population will either have or have access to a smartphone. And with that smartphone now, they can actually be bankable, right? So that means that, let's say, remittances. These are remittances across borders from one party to another. Let's say that there is a migrant who moves from Islamabad, Pakistan to Sweden, and they want to send money back to their family back in Pakistan. Well, they can go through Western Union, but it'll take, you know, a good week, and they'll get charged a pretty hefty percentage for a transaction fee. With Bitcoin, you can actually send this within minutes, and the transaction cost is very low. So already we're seeing, especially in that target segment, we're seeing a lot of Bitcoin exchanges happening.
So that lower 3 billion people in the world are actually engaged in the market as of today?
Yep.
Let me ask Chirag this. Why are you investing in the sector? I mean, it's very volatile. Every day you go and if you read the trades, the price goes up, it goes down. It was at 20,000, it was down to 2,000. I mean, why are you trading in this?
It's just the volatility that's attractive, but at the same time, it's kind of like swing trading with stocks, just a different type of market altogether. Because at the root of it all, it comes down to the technical analysis of it, trading on your highs, your lows. And even throughout cryptocurrencies coming and taking form, technical analysis is not going to go away. And, you know, that kind of led to me getting into cryptocurrencies when I was, you know, day trading stocks and, you know, saw another asset class and kind of experimented with it myself, read up on it. And now, you know, I'm at this stage where I have a hedge fund that has four different categories within it, in which I invest into different cryptocurrencies, heavily Bitcoin dominant, but also involved in ICO projects as well. You know, the utility tokens that are out there trying to create value for different products.
And for our listeners, what are ICO products?
That's an initial coin offering. So it's like the IPO of the crypto world.
Right. So when a new company comes to the marketplace or it becomes publicly traded, it's called initial public offering. And in this instance, in this sector, it's an initial coin offering.
Yes. And a lot of companies are doing this not only for their crypto to be established, but to also raise funds as well. So, you know, you issue, let's say, 10 million of your own coin, of your currency, to raise funds throughout it to basically fund the next 2 to 3 years of this technology and hopefully have it be fruitful and cash flow positive.
And I'll give an example. There's a, you know, just so you understand how these projects, it really is like a company. So the ICO or the coin becomes like a security. But let's take a Swiss company called Modem, where what they're trying to do is ensure the delivery of pharmaceuticals through the supply chain. So when you think about pharmaceuticals, they have to obviously go through temperature controls. They have to arrive at certain times. Some of these are very sensitive. And Modem is actually trying to infuse the supply chain with their blockchain technologies just to, you know, help pharmaceutical companies make sure that their product gets to market in a contained and safe way.
With all of these currencies out there, and the technology behind them, or are we really just trying to figure out and invest in the right adaptable and adoptable technology?
Right now, I believe so, yes. And as you said, you know, there have been 4,000 other alternative coins that have been issued. And Bitcoin, if you really look at it in terms of a financial carrier, it's not the most efficient, it's not the fastest. However, it has, as I said, you know, built that community around it, and it is a gold standard in the area, because you have you know, other currencies that perform these transactions at a fraction of the cost and much quicker as well.
So how do you think this will shake out? I mean, you're not going to have 4,000 coins and currencies and technologies
right
competing with each other in perpetuity.
Well, and Arnie, I the parallel that I draw, and it's not just me, these are folks who have been in this space for quite a long time, because, I mean, Bitcoin goes back 10 years at this point, but you have to draw parallels with Web 1.0. I mean, think back to 1998, 99, where, you know, you had a lot of companies that were getting hyped up, and then we obviously had the crash in 2000, 2001. And a lot of those companies went the way of the dinosaur. We never heard of those again. There was VerticalNet, and, you know, you can have an entire list of companies. But then you had a few that really came out of that, like Amazon, and Yahoo made it through, and Netflix, and so on and so forth. So I think what's happened, obviously we had a big crash in Bitcoin and other currencies, but it sort of shakes out everybody who's just in it for the hype, and now you're getting some real good use cases that are going in and actually addressing some of the shortcomings of Web 2.0.
Well, what do you expect to happen between these independent currencies and now companies, you know, like Amazon and others, creating their own technology and coins, so to speak? In my mind, it's the analogy these days, for example, if you go to one of the Disney theme parks, they have their own Disney currency. That's all you use in the park. What do you think is going to come out of the competition between independent currencies like Bitcoin that's not aligned with any one particular company and companies developing their own currency and their own technology?
And that's kind of, you know, taken form over the last 3-4 years, as you said, you know, with these alternative coins. But at the end of the day, if it's not creating value, it's not going to stay around. When you look at crypto assets, you have three different types. You have your cryptocurrencies, you have your security tokens, and your utility tokens. And your cryptocurrency is, you know, purely financially based. When you have your security and utility tokens, that's based on the underlying value of that asset. And very few cryptocurrencies out there are backed by real hard assets, such as gold or, let's say, you know, guns, things like that.
And then the third category is?
The utility tokens.
And how would you define a utility token?
That's basically, you know, let's say Amazon issues their own, right? Let's say they have an Amazon coin. And if you have people that are buying products day in, day out, if they're able to utilize that Amazon coin as opposed to using their credit card or their bank account, you have value being created within that ecosystem.
Mike, how do you think this is all going to shake out? I mean, it seems complicated and confusing. There's, you know, a tremendous amount of competition. Some people have a lot of resources behind them. Some you have no idea what resources are behind it, because in the case of Bitcoin, you don't even know who created it and what, you know, what is the driving force behind it. How is this all going to shake out?
Your question has so many different facets to it. The first thing is, I mean, yeah, Bitcoin is digital gold. And if you think about gold in and of itself, it's not that it has any utility. It's just that we value gold because we put value on it. So it's the same thing with Bitcoin. I think what's happened now is we see Facebook's, you know, having announced that they're going to have their Libra coin. So they want to get into the cryptocurrency space for their social network members. The issue there is that it's not going to be synonymous and it's not going to be permissionless. From a philosophical standpoint, it is not going to be sort of a cryptocurrency without an intermediary. Facebook is the intermediary, and then
they become the bank.
They have to become the bank. They're going to get regulated because they also have to then back up their stable coin. That's what it's called with fiat currency, which is the dollar or whatever it is. So they basically have to get regulated as a financial institution. However, I think it's pretty positive that at least they've come out and announced that they want to do this, because it gives credibility to cryptocurrencies. So sort of philosophically speaking, when we think about Bitcoin, it's sort of the most ideal version of a purely peer-to-peer currency, right? But of course, when you're thinking about real-world applications, we might have to scale back from that a little bit.
But as Chirag mentioned, it has all of those features, but the technology behind it isn't the best technology.
When you look at it, no. You know, you have other currencies such as Litecoin, you know, that really do what Bitcoin was intended to do on a much more efficient scale. But as I say, you know, you have something that's been built around over the last 10 years, and that's widespread in terms of being used on all corners of the world at this point.
We are speaking with Michael Braun and Chirag Patel about the complicated world of cryptocurrency. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. So who wants to take a crack at explaining to our listeners what blockchain technology is, which is the underlying feature of all of these coins and the whole sector in and of itself?
So blockchain is a technology that timestamps data and then encrypts it, and this through a block that is created every 10 minutes. So what you have is you basically have a chain of blocked information going back to the inception point of that data, and then it gets distributed in a ledger, basically, that exists on millions of computers. And the benefit of that is that it becomes very difficult to actually hack it. And here you got to go back a little bit and say, when we think about all this data that is being aggregated, a lot of it is centralized. It's in servers. And these servers, whether it's governments or companies or whatever it is, these servers are protected by a firewall. And a hacker goes in there, and then because that data is centralized, they can get all the access of that data, you know, all that personal information, whatever it is.
And it's happening all the time.
And it's happening on a weekly basis, right? Versus now you actually have to go out and you have to hack millions of computers, and you basically have to gain control of 51% of that entire network to actually be able to hack it. And that becomes very, very difficult.
Yeah, I agree. And as you say, you know, in order to do that 51% takeover, you really have to take over all these nodes that are running on all corners of the world. So as time goes on, Bitcoin's presence and its infrastructure is only getting stronger by the minute, which makes it kind of, you know, impervious to the hacks. But at the same time, you know, it's an immutable ledger. You can't edit it. And its main goal is transparency, to be able to have this information stored, but not being able to alter it or manipulate it.
So tell me a little bit about Bitcoin mining and what that's all about.
The mining itself. So Bitcoin is foundationally based as an algorithmic, I wouldn't say algorithmic currency, but it's based on the algorithm that the value itself keeps on increasing as these algorithms are kind of solved at each point. And what these miners aim to solve is basically hacking all these algorithms and being awarded with portions of Bitcoin on each hash, essentially. So at this point, you have 21 million Bitcoin that has been issued in the world, but 17.9 million are in circulation right now. So that means, you know, you still have roughly 3 million that are left to be mined over the next, let's say, 2 to 3 years.
And this data mining process mm-hmm. becomes more elaborate and complicated as time goes on, because you've already built a blocks of data, and this one has to recreate all, go through all of those that have been already done, and then add a new one on top.
Exactly, and it's only getting harder for these GPU units to keep processing this as time goes on. You know, back in 2009 to like 2013, the cost of mining Bitcoin was a fraction of what it is right now, and your reward was far more. So back then, you know, you were being awarded hundreds to thousands of Bitcoins. And then after the second halving, you know, you're getting awarded 10 to 40 Bitcoin. Now, after the third halving that's going to happen roughly May of 2020, you have the halving that's going to basically be issuing fractions of one Bitcoin per hash on there.
Right.
And to Arnie's point, I mean, you know, the computing power that is necessary to solve these algorithms is just increasing to the point where now all the computing power, all the energy that is being used to mine Bitcoins mirrors that of the entire country of Ireland.
So explain to our listeners again what halving is and also what CPUs are.
So it's the GPU is actually the graphic processing unit.
Okay.
But basically within that you have the halving. Bitcoin itself, you have it forking off. And it's, you know, from its inception. And each of these halvenings basically is kind of like a stock split within a company. With that, though, as Mike had said, you know, you really need higher processing power as time goes on to really solve these algorithms within it. And that's why you have a lot of pushback on these Bitcoin mining operations, which are not only very loud, but very intrusive, you know, to the community around them and polluting as well.
Well, we have several mining operations in Montana, one very close to Missoula in Bonner. What goes on inside that building?
Yeah, you basically have, you know, a server room full of these GPU units running 24 hours a day trying to get these hashes out. Your more efficient Bitcoin mining operations are taking place more so underground and using the waste that is coming from there and converting it into energy to be used for the mining operation itself.
Right. And a hash for our listeners is?
The hash rate is basically the time it takes to solve the algorithm.
So is there any particular industry that has been most quick to embrace cryptocurrency?
I mean, right now, obviously, you know, the financial industry as a whole, there's not a lot of trust when it comes to the banks and larger financial institutions. But that's, you know, that's one goal of the blockchain technologies. The other goal, you know, is across, you know, healthcare, automotive, education. You know, there are endless applications of this. It's whether it's practical to be having those areas on the blockchain or not.
Yeah, and to Chirag's point, I think Bitcoin is the first killer app of the blockchain revolution, if you will. But now what we're seeing is we're seeing applications of blockchain technologies really for internal efficiency uses, right? And we're seeing this a lot with supply chain. I mean, one of the companies that is really on the forefront of making blockchain technologies available is IBM, and they're working with some of the largest shipping companies to really streamline and make much more efficient the supply chain, right? So you want to think about, you know, all the steps that it takes, for instance, for a good to arrive from China in the UK and all the paperwork that goes through it. And what you're getting is, because of blockchain applications, you actually get to infuse smart contracts. So these are softwares that will make the decisions instead of people. They will say, okay, this thing went through customs here and it's got the necessary tariffs indicated and we know what it is. And all of a sudden you have technology basically replacing a lot of human labor to make sure that the product gets where it's supposed to go in the state from in which it actually left the port or even the factory.
So the industry really has matured from a point where it was considered by many as a means to engage in shady business dealings on the dark web, you know, which sounds very, you know, ominous, to being adapted across multiple industries that are engaged in financial transactions. Is that accurate?
Well, it's not just financial transactions. You want to think about any kind of asset out there that you can obviously digitize, right? So think about music. Think about art. Think about anything that is written, for instance, or titles, birth certificates. All of this is right now, I mean, you know, when you want to go get your birth certificate or your wedding certificate, you have to go down to Main Hall and ask for it, and then they'll make a copy of it. But now we can actually try to digitize that, and it becomes immutable, so you actually have access to it. Nobody can change it, right? And already there are companies out there like Civic and Sovereign. They will actually make digital blockchain-enabled wallets where you can store all this information, and then you can provide permission to whoever wants to use it without sort of worrying that it's going to end up in the middle of who knows where on the web, right?
Is there some irony in the fact that this all emerged because of the distrust in financial institutions, yet almost all the financial institutions that are distrusted are developing their own new blockchain and currency technology?
Yeah, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan. I mean, he was pretty outspoken about sort of thumbs down on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general. And then they announced that they were going to create their own. Again, I mean, here you get into sort of a philosophical discussion of whether it is a truly peer-to-peer distributed cryptocurrency or whether, you know, it's technology being used for the benefit of whoever is issuing it.
And it's kind of like the same principle, you know, you have larger financial institutions obviously talking down on Bitcoin the same way, you know, you have taxi services talking down on Uber and Lyft when they were at their inception, because, you know, you see that as a big threat to your whole business model. Same thing with hotels doing the same with Airbnb as they came on as well.
Chirag, what is your advice for a novice who wants to invest in the sector?
First, you know, I would research about the fundamentals of Bitcoin themselves. I always advise never blindly put your money into anything unless you yourself are comfortable with the knowledge of how that world operates. So that way you see, you know, the volatility, as you had mentioned. Let's say you open your wallet and you're down 10% on the day. your normal trader would, you know, be freaking out. However, if you're more well-versed into that world, that wouldn't really be so much of a shock to you.
And what's your biggest fear about the industry?
You know what? I think the genie is out of the bottle. I mean, when it comes to blockchain, it's here to stay, and it will fundamentally change our lives. I'm actually really excited about it. I mean, you know, I'm aging myself here, but I was there when internet 1.0, and I remember the first time I fired up my AOL on one of those disks, and it was, you know, it was life-changing. But when I learned about blockchain technologies 2.5-3 years ago, it was the same kind of excitement and the same kind of eagerness to see this technology be rolled out really for the benefit of individuals and companies and organizations who have lost control in this sort of wild west of the web.
So what do you think the industry is going to look like in 5 to 10 years? And what are you most excited about? I know you're excited in general, but as this thing unfolds, if we're 10 years into it now, what's it going to look like 10 years from now?
I think it's going to make a lot of life processes a little more efficient and easier. You know, from the financial transaction standpoint, being able to, let's say, you know, deposit your money and being able to take it out right away. Because right now, you know, you go to the bank, you deposit a check for $10,000, you don't have access to it hypothetically going to the bank for the whole weekend or for the 3 days until that processes. What these cryptocurrencies aim to solve is that you are able to take, you know, your currency and utilize it right away. So let's say, you know, I send Mike one Bitcoin right now. He's able to use that, ready to go from his wallet within 5 minutes.
Maybe I'm a little bit of a Joan of Arc on this one, but, you know, the way that I think about it is, it really peeves me when I think about how some of these intermediaries and some of these big data aggregators are using my information, right? So we're talking about Facebook, we're talking about Amazon, we're talking about Google and Apple and so on and so forth. And they say, you know what, use our services for free or whatever it is. But then they turn around and they monetize off of that. They make money off of my data, right? And
well, your life, in effect.
My life. And as we're sitting here, there's a virtual us, and that virtual us has a better memory of the real me. You know, the virtual me will remember what I watched a year ago or what I ordered a year ago. I don't have that. So now what we're going to be able to do is we're going to be able to basically put a fence around our digital identity and then give permission to whoever wants to use it. And they have to incentivize us, right? I mean, think about 23andMe. This is the genealogy company where people can figure out what their background is. I mean, there's nothing fundamentally more personal than your genetic makeup, your code. And already there are questions about how some of these companies like 23andMe are using that information. But with blockchain now, we can actually put a fence around it and we can say, you have to ask us permission if you want to use that. So it allows us to take some of that control back. And one last thing that I want to say on this is, you know, and this is a great article that came out today by the blockchain evangelist, Dan Tapscott. He talks about, you know, we're basically, as internet surfers, we're also serfs, S-E-R-F-S, to the feudal lords that are the Amazons and the Ubers and the Airbnbs who take that information and then figure out how to make gobs of money off of it.
Well, and that's the thing to remember at the end of the day. If you have a product that's free, let's say an app that's free, you are the product themselves. Because if you are using a product for free, let's say even Google, you're using it for free, but they're collecting the data off your searches and things like that to monetize off of that. So nothing is truly free if you really think about it.
Mm-hmm. So there's great fear about all of that. But what is your biggest fear about the cryptocurrency and blockchain industry itself?
I think just within it, the ones that are doing it for the wrong reasons. Like with any industry, you're going to have the scammers that come up in every industry. And 2018 really saw a rise in that. A lot of these pointless projects that kind of didn't go anywhere, and you had white papers copied from other currencies, the 4,000 others that are out there, and trying to solve the same thing that 300 other companies are trying to do. But, you know, when it comes down to the end of the day, it's who's doing it the most efficient and doing it the best.
My fear is simply that my cryptocurrencies will go to zero.
And why would that happen?
Well, I think that cryptocurrencies are their value is because of the participants in the network. And when you have participants leaving that network, then the value goes down, right?
So in other words, if Facebook comes up with a cryptocurrency that they market the heck out of and people are drawn to it because of all the bells and whistles and the marketing strategy for that, and they're drawn to it from the other currencies like Bitcoin, the value of Bitcoin will go down.
Possibly. I think, again, Bitcoin is always going to be a little bit of a different animal versus sort of that closed system of Libra coin with Facebook, where it's really among the users within Facebook. But, you know, I don't look at it as sort of a win-lose. If anything, Libra coin is just a validation of cryptocurrencies and even Bitcoin.
This conversation reminds me of a quote from Hunter Thompson, where he said that he opened one of his books with the line, there's a lot of wreckage in the fast lane these days, and there's going to be a lot of wreckage. 4,000 coins won't be around 5 years from now. So there will be winners and losers, and there will be industry dominators, and then, you know, Bitcoin or cryptocurrency 2.0, 3.0, and 4.0. That appears to be what the future may hold. Is that correct, Chirag?
I believe so, yeah, along those lines. Within the next, 10, 20 years, we're going to see all of this shakedown. You're going to, like with any industry, see the ones that are most dominant and really providing value to the people, as opposed to the ones that are just kind of out there doing their own thing and not really creating value for their asset or for the people.
So in general, is it fair to characterize both of you as being excited about the future rather than view it with trepidation?
Still excited regardless, to see where this goes. But even to Mike's point, if you have participants leaving that network, your value does go down.
Right.
So, in that event, if something does shake down to the point that Bitcoin comes out as something that's not a safe store of value, it's going to take a lot to really drive down that value.
Yeah, I mean, on my end, I wish the future were already here. Again, I come at it from the shortcomings that I live through as somebody who obviously, does a lot of work. I write articles, I publish materials, I do a lot of things where, the advent of blockchain will actually allow me to take some of that control back, and it'll empower me as a knowledge creator and allow me to monetize off of it and retain a little bit more control.
Mike, Chirag, it's been a very informative and enlightening conversation, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. Us.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs. Produced by Peter Hogue and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guests' contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time when our guest will be Walt Baralt, discussing the challenges and opportunities of running a 45-year-old family hospitality business in a highly competitive environment. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you peace and prosperity.